This is Julia Barbaro, host of the Julia and Gino podcast. I'm here with the co-founder of Jake and Gina, my co-host and husband, Gino Barbaro.
Julia, you're looking a little tan today. What happened yesterday,
we were at the
girl?
Beach a little too long. Let's just be honest. I feel like I'm radiating heat from my forehead.
Time out. You were at the beach yesterday while somebody was in the office working.
Yes, okay. I sent you a picture.
And you look good in the picture. Are you all happy with the big glasses? That was pre-burn. Post-burn last night, I'm tired. I'm burned.
Oh,
I'm
like, yeah, terrible. Baby, you see that? All of the kids. Yes, I know. A little too much.
That is karma. Okay. I'm sorry. I had to get into that because I see you're glowing on the camera. You do look beautiful. I mean, amazing as usual. Let me get our guest over here because I'm super excited about this podcast. I mean, I'm going to hold up the book. This book, Raising Men, I read it. It's awesome. We're excited to be interviewing author, former Navy SEAL, sniper instructor, and entrepreneur Eric Davis. Today, Eric is leveraging his training and operational expertise to elevate the performance of corporate and individual clients through his business, Average Frog. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
I have to say, this is one of my favorite topics, fatherhood. It really is. I just like the need of fatherhood in the world is so important. And so I love talking about it. So I'm really excited about this.
Eric, why did you write the book? What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I think the story is actually in the book. That's one of those weird things when you write a book a few years ago, it's always that, wait, did I write that in the book? But I was sitting in the airport away from my daughter, once again, away from my kids, just reflecting on my role as a father and as a parent. And it was feeling a little down in the moment. But then as I thought about it, I thought about all the things I've been doing with them, all the things I've taught them. You know, just kind of this unconventional way of being with them. And it hit me. I'm like, wow, you know, so many things that I've learned as a SEAL, then as a sniper instructor, where I spent 5 years studying human performance with Olympic gold medalists, you know, behavior science, all of these things that related to parenting and that I was using all of the time. And it hit me. I'm like, you know, I think people would be interested. I would be interested in a book like that. I mean, although I was a SEAL, what I really was is I was always a fan. I just thought SEALs were really cool. And I was just such a big fan, I like went and became one. So I always had that orientation like, oh yeah, I would read a book like that. So that's what kind of launched the seed.
In the book, you say parenting is similar to warfare, symmetrical versus asymmetrical. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah. And ooh, that's a big one. So if you think about maybe symmetrical warfare or traditional warfare, or if you really want to exaggerate the concept, go way, way back when like the redcoats stood in line and we stood in line and then shot each other, your enemy was right in front of you. That's how I would over-exaggerate like symmetrical warfare. Just bam, there's the enemy, let's fight. Now, asymmetrical warfare, if you think about all of the things kids are dealing with now, from sexuality to gender to pronouns to like you can go on and on and on. And what's happening is there is, and I'm not saying those things are right or wrong, but what I'm saying is opinions and agendas from multiple sources now have access to our children under the cloak of entertainment. And with the support of habit or addiction or dopamine release, which we can unpack all that. Nothing. That's just how it works, right? We go to something we like. We feel good. When we feel good, we tend to return to it. And I would say the moral of that story there is it used to be a father and a mother too, but I'm typically speaking to fathers with this book. It used to be a father could wake up, grab his lunch pail, his Stanley coffee, you know, thermos, go to the factory, pound nails or rivets or whatever that was, come home, hit the recliner, pop the TV on, drink a beer and ignore the kids or marginally spend time with them. But now it's a very different story. We need to be wise. We need to understand philosophy. We need to understand science, art, engineering, spirituality, all these different topics so that we can receive their narratives, hear, listen to their narratives, and then help, I'm going to say correct them. Again, not from the context of right or wrong, correct them to lead them to the life, their authentic life, to who they really are meant to be rather than who they're being told to be from other people. Does that make sense how I'm saying that? That's what I mean by asymmetrical warfare. And most parents and fathers have no clue that's even going on.
It does, because the next question that I had is, what is the role of the father? And you started diving into that. And a lot of fathers out there aren't educated. And I would just tell everybody, there's always agendas. There's always follow the money. I mean, when there's something being thrown out there, where is the money following through? You mentioned gender. Now you have gender affirming care and all that. Well, look at the doctors and the money that's being supported by that. And is that a wise idea for a 7 or 8 year old to be taking these puberty blockers? I don't think so. But you look at the doctors and the money that's being thrown into that sphere, make the decision for yourself. So that's just one area. We can go into climate change where tons of money is going into that. Is that happening? Not sure, but you always follow the money trail. And I think to me, that's an important thing that fathers and I think moms, we need to be educated and then sit down, like you said, with our children and discuss that as a family and how it works for your family. But the role of the father, let's continue along with that. I love how you started that. Anything else that you could add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Just one thing on that piece right there. One of the things I notice with my kids, especially my girls, is social media and these different agendas. Again, I'm not saying one's good or bad. I mean, I have opinions on that, but I just want people to be clean on how I'm expressing this. If you were to go to a child when they're 4 years old and be like, "Do you like broccoli?" They'd probably say no. I'm like, okay, well, you're a non-broccoli then. But when they're 15, 16, 18, you know, you develop tastes for vegetables at different times, right? So now I love broccoli, and you can actually condition yourself to love broccoli even if you hated it. That's how behavior science works. So my point I would make right there is there's so much pressure on gender and sexuality so early. Like if you would have asked me when I was 8 or 9 years old, "Do you like girls?" I'd be like, no, they're chasing me all over the place. They make me nervous. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, then, but that's what's happened. They're like, oh, that means you don't like girls, which means you must X, Y, Z. Again, I'm not going to the right or wrong in that conversation, but what I am saying, there's a tremendous amount of pressure to make choices and decisions before the children are ready for it. Before they have the maturity.
The beauty of the parents, you know, all of my girls, we have 5 girls, all of them at one point in their life were a cat, and it was really irritating. I'm going to be honest. My mom actually encouraged it, and she would joke around. We'd make creme de la creme. They watched Aristocats a little too much probably at the time. But then there was a moment where it was dinner time, and me as the parent was like, okay, now you're no longer a cat. Let's move on. And I think a lot of times as parents, we get nervous. We want the kids to love us and like us. And so we tend to like let them make the rules, let them decide what time bedtime is. You know, funny that you mentioned broccoli, because my girls are convinced that those children that do not like broccoli, the parents don't know how to cook it. That's what they tell me. So yeah, probably.
Probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We use a lot of garlic. But it's interesting. I think as a parent, you're so afraid, especially nowadays. I think parents are so afraid, especially men. They don't know how to communicate with their kids because they're basically, you guys are battling society and social media and what they're hearing. And now you're on the other side saying, hold on a second, let's find what the truth is. So how do you handle that now? Because you have older children.
Yes, older and in the teens, right? And that's when, while we're on that, and we're going to get back to my definition of a father as well, or my role as a father, or as long as you hold that in your notes, we're coming back to that.
Yeah.
But what's happened, that's when the parenting really starts, right? A lot of people are like, oh, I'm done parenting at 18. I'm like, what? No, that'd be like saying you're done coaching when you go to the Super Bowl. Now they're in the game. Now it's time to be relevant. Now it's time to be wise. Now it's time to be ready to coach them for real, right? So that's a big deal. And I'll loop back now into if it works. I'm going to talk about my definition of fatherhood because it really applies here. So one of the things I'm working with my girls, I got to coin a phrase for it. And if we coin it together, we can co-own this phrase. But one of my daughters was talking about conservatives versus liberals. I'm a pretty apolitical guy. That's not my wheelhouse. But I was explaining to her, like, well, what do we call somebody who all of their opinions and thoughts and actions have been generated by social media and people's opinions? So we have a liberal, we have a conservative. So we're working on a name for that. And she's like, you know what, Dad, you're right. Like, that is where all my opinions come from. And that to me is where the fight is. So I'm not trying, I've had conversations about abortion, sexuality, all of these things with them. And I want us to have these conversations, but what I'm leading them to is to ground their opinions and their assertions and the things that they're going to be committed to and take a stand on with what is true and real for them, not based off the marketing machine. Because to your point, right? You know, follow the money. Like if you're getting it for free, there's something going on there to look out for. And this brings me to my definition of masculinity or fatherhood. Our job as a father is, I can say it a couple ways. One is to figure out how to leverage our passion to fulfill our purpose. And what I mean by that, it means we wake up, we love what we do all day, every day, and it fulfills our purpose, which is lifestyle, financial, career, and business, which means that passion. See, there's a difference between passion and a hobby. A hobby is something you love to do, and that's great, but real passion, the way I teach it anyways, it's something you love to do, and it generates. It helps other people at a level high enough to generate the income that you require to care for your purpose now and the 30 plus years of old age. So that's one fundamental way of saying it. Another way I can say that is our job is to figure out how to live our authentic self. And if you look at passion, if passion are flow state producing activities, right? You're in the zone, you love what you do. Well, that means you're living your authentic self. You guys get what I'm saying? You're living who you were created to be, or who, if you don't want to go creation, who you were bred to be, it's up to you, but you're living you, right? And that's the role of a father, and it's to show kids the conventional, unconventional strategies that are now required to allow you to live that way. So that, to me, is masculinity. The problem with cultural masculinity, it's absolutely not that, and that, to me, is the role of a father.
And what have you learned from the SEALs, other than the asymmetrical, the warfare, the analogy you made, what else has the SEALs taught you about being a good father?
So it started with, and this is where I started when I became an entrepreneur in 2008. It started with me getting really, really good at getting people really, really good at things. I called expert at becoming an expert. So that's a good skill to have. People want that. It's useful. You can help your kids with all kinds of different things. If you want to have them be courageous or confident, there's a formula to break that down so that you can have them in the right practices to produce those end results. So that's where it all started. And if you think about it, let me back up. That's where it started. When I came out as an entrepreneur and started consulting and training, that's what I was doing. I was getting people good at whatever they wanted to get good at, either it was making money, whether it was fitness, relationship, whatever they were working on, I could give them the formula and walk them through that. But I realized that didn't actually improve their ability to live a good life. So what was missing was an underlying fundamental strategy that people need to travel through in our current environment. Now, when they travel through that, they get to leverage their passion to fulfill their purpose or live their authentic self. However we want to say, live their authentic self in a way that works, has things work out for them in all aspects of life. But what I realized is when I came into fatherhood, I'm like, okay, I'm going to use unconventional principles because I want to produce an unconventional result. So that came from the SEAL team. So I would say there's a variety of things you learn, but at the core is fundamental principles that apply to any situation. Does that make sense? And I can go into different things, but really at the core, that's what we're talking about.
And when in your life, can you think back, you were not living your authentic self, and what did that do for you?
Yeah. So when I teach passion, I start off with a little bit of a backstory, and I explain to people that I didn't actually like being a SEAL. And if you think about that, like, well, it's known to be the most demanding training in the world, requires an incredible amount of sacrifice or discipline. At least that's people's opinions. And that's actually not as true as people think, but we can unpack that one later. But what I explained to them was, if you're looking at passion, what I'm passionate about is I like to wake up, I like to put my head down and get after something for hours on end that I know, or I believe, will produce a good life for me and my family in the future. SEAL training is that. That's what SEAL training is, but the actual job of a SEAL is different. You do train and you refine skills and everything like that, but a lot of it's deploying, working with your platoon, being staged overseas, doing operations, and I've pirated over 20 ships and done multiple things like that, and that like's kind of cool, but like that's not my passion. My passion is to wake up, put my head down, get after something that's caring for all of my concerns. Another way to say that's going to care for my current situation and my future, but all of my concerns. So as fathers, as humans, we all fundamentally share about a dozen human concerns that we all share. We're talking family, body, spirituality, helping others, fun, our tribe and our friends. And that was breaking my ability to care for those concerns. So that was my first, I didn't realize it at the time. I was just like, ah, man, this kind of, something sucks, you know, but that's in looking back after I studied this, that was when I started to really realize what my passion was.
I'm curious as fathers, because you both are fathers, you know, we get into the role of being that protective father, and you both have girls, especially, and you come to the point where they're in trouble or they're going through something. And your first thought, I'm assuming, is to protect them and to take care of the situation. You know, I'm curious, Eric and Gino, how do you avoid taking over and just, you know, especially the older kids, you know, the younger kids is one thing, but once they get to a certain point, we're trying to teach them how to be brave, how to be courageous, how to take care of their situation without making decisions based off emotion only. So how do you teach your children how to take care of a situation, whether it's a relationship situation or something with, you know, like a bully type of person? Or how do you, is it hard for both of you to not step in and take over?
So how I'd answer that is to model the behavior that you're wanting them to learn and to be wise, to be knowledgeable. So we live in a very competitive environment, which means it's dynamic, and any competition means things are going to change all the time. And it's knowledge-based, right? It's not really about going to the factory and pounding rivets. Nothing wrong with that. People do need to do things like that. But you can see that we're drifting way away from that kind of manufacturing kind of situation. And I bring all that up for this point. It's a knowledge-based economy. So if you're not studying art, science, engineering, and philosophy, that kind of thing every single day, you're not going to be relevant. There's no way you're going to be able to keep up with the environment and all of the changes if you're not studying fundamental things that are always true. So if this makes sense, another way I'd say is to maintain respect and authority in your children's life. So if they respect you and they grant you authority, meaning that you can't, like I have a 19-year-old daughter, we are talking about drinking and things like that, and like, I am your father and I am telling you, no, you do not drink until you're 21. If she grants me that authority, she will not drink until she's 21. If she does, come tell me and we're going to work through it. I mean, it's not like this dictator kind of situation, but I would say that's how I would do that. That's how you prevent yourself from stepping in. If they respect you and grant you authority, they're going to listen and you're not going to have to push in. But they won't respect you and grant you authority if you're a tyrant. I mean, there's more to it. You can't demand respect. Mm-hmm. Respect is either given, you know what I mean, or it's not. So
there's a story important. In the book that you have. I'm not going to answer the question because I could talk about an hour. So
let me hear your answer.
So my answer really quick is that my children know that literally I would take a bullet for them. They know that I am always there for them. They know that I love them implicitly. I don't love something, things that they do, but I love them all. And I have six and they all think that I love them the most, which means that I really show up for them all the time. They all have boundaries. And as they get older, their boundaries get pushed out a little bit. They can usually come to me with anything. And the funny thing is every day I say something stupid to all of them. So I know that they don't not love me because I'm saying stupid things or making mistakes. I think they understand that I am human and that dad's sorry. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but once or twice a week, right? I usually on average. So I am fallible. I make them want to understand that. But then I will always be there for them. Whatever they need, I think that's truly important. But in the book, you had a little story about throwing a PlayStation in the pool and letting your son go get it in freezing water. And I told my kids and they were horrified. And I'm like, I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's consequences. And maybe if our children knew that there were consequences to their actions, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in every, whether we're talking about the president doing certain things that he shouldn't be doing or corporate or Sam Bankman-Fried or Silicon Valley Bank. There's actually consequences to your actions. So just share that story with the listeners and, I just love the story. I'm like, I don't know if I could do that. I could see where he's coming from. That is really effective, but entertaining to say the least.
Yeah. So real quick on what you said about consequences. So a core fundamental principle for me as a parent is to make sure that their life is commensurate with their skill and effort. So I can give my kids gifts and things like that, but you see children getting spoiled all the time, especially from affluent families or when they perceive they're affluent. And that spoils them. And I describe it, it's like, well, there's an obstacle course before your children. There's an obstacle course between them and their passion and purpose. And it's kind of like from a spiritual belief for me, it's like something pretty big put that in front of them to develop them into their highest level of self as an individual and as a member of a team. Now, an obstacle course, like on the SEAL obstacle course, when I remember going through it, I remember like, man, this is so cool. I'm like getting faster and I'm getting tougher. Because you're always getting knocking into thing, you know what I mean? It's a pretty rigorous thing. And I'm like, man. And then I was to the point like nothing even hurts me on this thing. Now, what I see a lot of parents do is they don't allow their kids' life to match up with their skill and effort. So they're lifting them up and over the obstacle course and just totally, I want to think of just the nastiest word I can think of, just atrophying every muscle, every bit of courage, every bit of confidence, and just destroying their children. And then we see those kids just sitting at home, just making up whatever they need to make up so they don't have to get off the couch. So little sidebar on that. So I'm with you on that for sure, Gino. Now let's talk about that story. So so I had a Belgian Malinois, and Belgian Malinois are attack dogs. They're like German Shepherds. For people that don't know them, they're about 30% smaller and 30 to 50% nastier. These dogs are wired. I trained this dog in protection, home protection. So when I was gone, it could protect the family. So it was a bite dog, a protection dog, all of these things. So I learned a lot about behavior science. I think it's even in the book too. Like I think it's either raise your kids like a dog or something like that. Behave. If you're a parent and you don't understand behavior science, it's like, well, aren't you molding and modifying your children's behavior so that they are allowed to, they're able to live an authentic, happy life? It's almost like should be a requirement, in my opinion. But obviously, I parented for many years before I learned that because nobody teaches you these things. So coming back to the PlayStation story. So there's a thing people say the punishment should fit the crime. Well, no. In the world of behavior science, the punishment or the reward should fit the desired behavior. Makes sense?
Yes.
Now, with a dog, a Belgian Malinois, as tough as they are, if you just haul off and whack that thing or zipper them with an electric collar, like there's very humane way, like I use an electric collar, but like my dog would just go like, what was that? You know what I mean? It's almost just like a little tiny sort of a physical reminder, like, hey, we have a language barrier here. So I need to somehow physically let you know I'm trying to communicate with you. So I just want to give people that because there's some people misusing those things with dogs. Anyways, back to the kids. So the punishment should fit the desired behavior and it should fit the child. Some children could not handle anything like that. That would be abusive. That could be horrible. So you can't say as a parent to one other parent, like, oh, you should spank their butt. So my daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, like she's gone a little hysterical on me twice. And one time I just like whacked her butt, but I know her. We have a relationship. It wasn't a physical strike. It was me going, popped her on the butt like, hey, it's okay. And she's like, oh yeah, thank you for that. You know what I mean? It really has to fit the child. And
you change your state. That's exactly what you did. You're just changing the state. You're changing her physiology for that second is basically what you're doing at that moment. And she can handle it. Some other kids cannot handle it. They may be more sensitive or you don't have that relationship and they just take it a different way. I agree.
100%. Just like a guy in the locker room, like, hey, buddy, good game. Smack him on his butt. Could be really appropriate and even loving for one guy. And another guy, you'd be like, dude, you just touched me. you know what I mean? Anyway, so I'm kind of unpacking this one. So let's come back to that story. So, yeah, so my son, I came home. He had done what he did. And I was like, okay, let's go. Grab your skateboard, grab your PlayStation, and meet me in the backyard. And what he was doing is he was like being a little obstinate. Like he didn't want to communicate with his father. The mood wasn't there. And I'm like, okay, I need to shift the environment here. So first, let's communicate since we're not talking right now, since we're sub-language. You know what I mean? Since you've decided to go below the line. And somebody can make a good case for waiting until he was above the line. But I don't know. Sometimes it's like consequences are coming right now. So you know exactly what they're connected to. Brought him out there. threw it in the pool, made him go get it. He grabbed the stick for the pool, and I'm like, no, with your body, go get it. So he did all that. He was still there. I'm like, you know, I can tell, I'm like, all right, you're not cracking. So I took his skateboard. We have side like rockscape around the pool and everything, and just smashed it. We're not violent, not in a way that would scare him, like he thinks his dad's losing it. I was very calm, and I'm like, okay, like a SEAL instructor would do that. They would do that to your helmets all the time. They just start smashing it, you know. And he's brought up with all those stories and SEALs around him, and did some damage to the skateboard. I'm like, those things are now gone. He still wasn't there, and I'm like, you know what? The problem is he's not connected with his dad right now. Like, we don't, like, if you go back to a dog analogy, that little shock collar, right? Nobody put a shock collar on your kid unless you think it's funny. But that little, I mean, you can have fun with it. But that little shock collar with the dog, what it would do is it's caught up in its world and its emotion in a squirrel or whatever it is. So it's like, hey, you know, hey, I am stepping in as your father, not your friend. Like, this is now how this is going to go. Like, you did things, and now this is what it looks like afterwards. So my favorite part of the story was it wasn't working. So there's a trail by our house, lots of hills and trails by our house. And it was night. It was dark at this point. So I said, okay, let's go. Grab your stuff. Put on your shoes. We're going up in the trails. So we got there, and he's kind of hanging back because he's mad at dad. Or he's, you know what I mean? He's not feeling the vibe. So I'm like, okay. So I went up the trail, and I just kind of ran into a little trot, and the lights from the streets all went away. It got dark, and he did what he had been conditioned to do. So all of their life, I've taken them rock climbing, nothing crazy extreme, by the way, people, kind of like normal family, just doing some stuff that would, like, oh, that would have anyone concerned with their survival. I've been out in the ocean. I've been in the pool. I think this is in the book. Like, I've put them in many situations where they're like, I need to look at dad. Like, this is a little sketch. I'm not, like, something's feeling a little bit off. I need to look to dad right now. This makes sense? Mm-hmm. So I just used that tool. I used that relationship with him. And I'm like, I went up and started getting a little dark. And guess what he did? My little son just right up next to me, arm around him. And then we started to have a good conversation about what was going on. Really
important. Wow, that's amazing. It's amazing that you kept doing something else, because a lot of times parents, we give up so fast because we're frustrated, and we do react by emotion at times as well, because we don't know what to do. We don't know why it's not working. You know, we get to the point where if our kids are misbehaving, it's our fault. We put it on ourselves, and then we get angry at them. When a lot of times, because I've done this before, where I'm like yelling at the kids and they're looking at me and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm actually feeling at fault because I didn't teach them properly. I didn't actually teach them this, whatever it was that I was getting mad at. But I do love the fact that you kept trying things, because a lot of us just give up. We get mad, we have some kind of consequence, and then we go back to whatever we're doing and we ignore the problem, which I'm 100% guilty many, many times. But I do love how you tried three different things and you waited for the one for your son to come to you. And because a lot of times we don't give our kids the space, or we don't give them the okay to take your time.
Correct.
Well, is that reason why? Because we want instant results. We want that instant gratification. We want to get it over.
Sometimes it's about us.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next problem. So I think that's part of it. And in the book, you said being right versus being effective.
Yeah.
I mean, go into that, because I think that's an important element. You want to be effective in life, but it seems like we're always wanting to be right.
Yeah. So it actually will go right off that point Julie was making. When you're describing that, the visuals I had in my head are watching people with their dogs. That's the exact same thing people are doing with their dogs.
I love how you connect, right? The dogs and the kids. I think it's hysterical.
Yeah. Well, it's behavior science is why. There's no such thing as a bad dog. There's only a bad owner. No such thing as a bad kid. There are 100%. Some psychological limits, I understand, that are beyond what we're talking about here. So you guys
100% agree. Mm-hmm.
Within normal limits, it is on us as a parent. Now, what you're talking about there, Gino, you might have to bring me back to that question, because I got to dig in on this just a little bit, is there's a victim role and a hero's role. What a victim does is something happens we feel anxiety or emotion that we do not want to feel, like this is not working for me. And then we take action. And when do you think a victim stops taking action? When the results are produced or when the anxiety is gone? How do we get rid of anxiety? It's a very effective way to yell, scream, just get it all out. And that's what we're doing. But as a victim, what happens is we're going to deal with that problem over and over and over again because we stopped action, not when it was solved or not when we were effective, but when the anxiety was settled, when the anxiety came down. Now on the hero side, we pull things through. This is what I teach a lot to a lot of executives and professionals. It's like you guys keep getting things done, but you don't put something in place to make sure it stays. It doesn't get pulled through and doesn't get maintained. Mm-hmm. So on the hero side, we're going to look to be effective. So being right would be our opinions as a parent and things like that. We're going to do what we feel like doing, what we think is right. It's like, well, don't do what you think is right. Do what you know is effective. And coming back to parenting, and I'm not like some crazy dog person, but it's just because they're so good at the behavior science. Then the dog people are crazy, but they're so crazy. Do you know they keep spreadsheets of the rewards they give their dog and what level of reward that is? Could you imagine if a parent had any idea of three levels of reward for their kid, just that alone? So they're crazy, but I love them because, man, did they give us a gift. And make sure I recommend a book on that before I leave. So where I'm going, that being right is a prideful, arrogant, selfish pursuit that has everything to do with managing our feelings in the moment. How, and Gino has a wonderful example of the apologies he said he gave to the kid. That is the most powerful, authoritative, generating, way to generate authority and respect there is. Leaders are never perfect, but leaders will be the ones to be like, yep, that was on me. I missed that one. Apologies for that. Here's how I'm going to correct it. I'm committed to never doing it again. Let's move forward. So that's being effective, not being right. Being right would be like, you, because, why? Because I said so. Like, oh
yeah,
that one's
a bad one.
unless it's time. So we had a policy of we never would default to saying no. Mm. Now, this is weird. So it's going to sound like Eric saying like, we never said no to our children. That's not what I'm saying. We never would just say no. So mm-hmm. when our children heard the word no, they always knew that we gave it thinking and gave it reason. Mm. Which also gave us the space and permission to say, no, why not? Because I said so, I don't have time to unpack it right now. Let's go. And they're like, okay, that's cool. I get it. Yeah. That's true. I don't want to unpack it right now. Okay, got it. I can deal with that.
Yeah. I like that one because we do, as parents, we use that authority a little too much, I think. And we don't put out that reason. You know why? Because it's a lot of effort on us. It's a lot of time. I mean, it took me to have four children to realize that I sometimes need to sit with them and explain what's happening in life, in my world. But I got there. I did. And now it's kind of it's an exhausting conversation sometimes. And a lot of parents just don't want to be bothered. And that's really, unfortunately, what it comes down to. So they just say, no, we can't do that. And that's it. And there's no explanation. And the kid detaches from the parent because of it. Because over time, right? Over time, it's like, all right, why bother even asking my mom? She's going to say no anyway. So I'm not going to go to somebody else and talk to them. And I think that's what happens. It's that relationship that, you know, especially as a parent, fathers, mothers, they're always there. We're never no longer a parent. You know, when the kids are toddlers, obviously they need us differently when they're teens from when now they're young adults and getting into relationships, into marriage, into kids. I mean, we're always in their life. We're always a role playing, and we have to realize that it's going to be different and we have to adjust, but we have to constantly put in that effort, and it is completely exhausting at times.
Yeah, so it for sure can be. Now, we're on the dog analogies, but they're just the best example. Okay. If you watch a professional dog trainer work with, I would hire trainers, and I'd watch the professional dog trainer work with my dog to get her at like a really good heel, like right up by your side. Or you're a dog that didn't have that, to get in there, it's effortless and it takes minutes. Parents, we are professional children trainers. if we don't understand behavior science and develop it like a skill, it is going to be very difficult. Now, Julie, I'm with you. I'm not saying I haven't been through all of that.
I'm going to my extremes, my really difficult days. You know, yeah. It's not like that anymore, but it used to be painful. But again, I didn't know it. I had to learn it. And
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And, you know, good people, good parents, what they're going to do is they're going to find their way to that science. Because I'm just not going to quit until I figure it out. I think my story is there for parents to just like, just get there faster. It's going to be easier on everybody. You know what I mean? Easier on everyone. Much more fun. Really fun to have a dog when they're well-trained and you know how to train them. Really sucks when they don't. Yeah.
So what you're saying is it really sucks when your kids don't listen to you.
It is very rewarding.
It's really great when your wife listens to you and she's trained and she does what she's supposed to, right?
That's right. I don't know. That's all right.
That one I have no, I can't help you. I don't know how that works. Tell me, Gina, when you figure it out. Yes, I'm curious.
It's all right. I know his sense of humor. We're 25 years this year.
Do I have a sense of humor at all?
Yes,
so,
you do.
Listen, I have just a couple more questions. I think this is important. Mm-hmm. You talked about as far as leaders, that's why our leaders are terrible nowadays. No one wants to apologize. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the humility aspect of a parent, because you know, humility is really, really important. Those who shall be exalted shall be humbled. Those who shall be humbled shall be exalted. Mm-hmm. How does that play into the role of a father?
Yeah, real good. So again, we're going to preface this with, we live in the most competitive and dynamic environment that this planet has ever seen. And what that means is there's change. That means that we're heading somewhere and then there's going to be barriers or gaps or cliffs. There's always going to be something, a challenge for us to go through, which is wonderful if you're good at going through challenges, right? Now, the opposite of humility is pride. So if you're standing at the edge of a cliff, right, and there's a chasm between you and where you need to go, pride tells you that you can get there with nobody's help. Humility fills the gap in with the help of others. Make sense?
Yes.
So it's very masculine. Matter of fact, it's a catchphrase in marketing, do it yourself, DIY. That's the worst advice I've ever heard. Self-reliance, independence, everything like that. Now, that we'd have to unpack that one deeper, but you don't do anything alone. So humility says I need constant help. Humility says I'm raising my kids. They're a pain in the butt. Pride tells us we're going to solve that through force or effort or energy. Like, we're going to solve that. Humility says, nope, get help, read a book. Nope, get help, go to a counselor. Nope, get help, go somewhere so that you are not right, but you're effective. How's that? Do you know that to me is the big difference between
that. That sounds excellent. If my kids are listening to this, Eric said a few times that we live in the most competitive world. Children, yes, I'm coming at you. I am a competitive person. They say, oh, Daddy, I'm not that competitive. But when my daughter about 6 months ago said to me, Dad, you want to play chess? I said, "Not." She goes, I'll go easy on you. I'm like, game on, baby. Bring it. And you know what? She crushed me after six That's movies, right. So I learned
You're
my thing. But
you.
Competitiveness okay. and being competitive and not just wanting to win, but being part of that has to carry on into your life, because everything you do in your life, I'm not trying to compete against Eric. I'm trying to compete to be the best version of myself, because I have to learn certain skills and how do I get better? By challenging myself. And I don't think people are challenging themselves nowadays. I think that's what's going on in society. And I think us as fathers need to challenge our kids and need to say, hey, there is competition out there. And it's okay if you want to get a prize for second or third. That's fine. Let's acknowledge that you at least played. But try to compete against yourself and try to get better than you were today. That's my whole vision of
competition. What's your thought on that, Eric? I'm curious.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Gino. So they're saying, don't compare yourself to others. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday. I would actually update that and be like, one, I believe it is okay to compare yourself to others. Just imagine being in a foot race and not comparing yourself to others. That ain't going to work. You certainly aren't going to do your best. Competition, by definition, is bringing out the best in each other. Now, so I would say compare yourself to your purpose. So when I go back to that, your authentic, your passion and your purpose, you have a purpose. You were created for a reason. It's all around you, family, fitness, we can go through that, but it's like, okay, well, you have those things at a certain level, at a certain standard. To tomorrow, compare where you were with those things. Compare yourself to your ideal self. Being better than I was yesterday, that's kind of easy. I could read one line in the Bible and be like, I am better than I was yesterday. Who cares? And let me say another thing about competition. I deal with this when I work anywhere around a nonprofit or a church. Sometimes they don't like the word competition. Well, think about this. We are compensated. Here's the most beautiful thing I learned about money. It's from a gentleman named Toby Heck of the Audgy Network, one of my early mentors. When I left the teams, I was like, man, is my life going to be all about money now? Or, you know what I mean? I felt like I did have this huge purpose there. I didn't love it, but it's like, man, that was a pretty cool purpose to hear about yourself in the news and things like that. But he's like, no, Eric, how you make money is by helping other human beings care for their concerns. I was like, huh. So if I'm going to make the kind of money that I need to fulfill my purpose, to care for my concerns now in the 30 plus years of old age. If you do the math, that's millions of dollars. But here's the cool thing about that. It means I'm competing with other people in the marketplace, but what am I competing to do? I'm competing to be a better help and value to the human beings I serve. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you take quote unquote, at least the philosophical definition of money out of it, right, you're no longer going to be competitive, which means you're now going to reduce the level of help. So because we're in a competitive environment, it demands that we become higher, more and more help to other human beings. It is the most beautiful manifestation of love. It's when I started to learn, like when you learn real business philosophy and things like that, it's connected to my spiritual journey. It was connected to the word of God. I was like, this is amazing. Now, let me say one more thing about competition for your daughter. I was in a business meeting. Teaching leadership and management inside of a large organization. We were around with all the C-suite, all the executives, talking about competition. It was just one of those intimate conversations between the trainers and the guys. And I'm like, actually, I don't like competition at all. I said this. And they're like, what? That's surprising. They're like, no, I like to be so far out ahead that there is no competition. And, you know, these guys are older than me too. Even though I was there teaching, they had all this amazing wisdom. And they're like, Eric, that is the highest form of competition. You are so competitive, you don't want anyone to touch you. And I was like, oh, that's what I like. I like to just be so better than everybody else. You know what I mean? I don't have to feel that anxiety of the competition. So that might be what your daughter's saying, as she did when she stomped you in chess. She's like, yeah, I don't want to be competitive, Dad. I just want to smoke you in six moves and go down.
You baited me, bro. It was the funniest thing in the world. I'm like, really? Seriously? I had a few choice words in my mind, never shared them. I'm like, really? I get you back. Don't worry. Every time we get the tennis racket, I smoke her still. So before we sign off, you said you had to share a book with us. What book did you want to share with us?
Oh, so just to close out all the dog analogies, there's a book called Don't Shoot the Dog, and it'll talk about behavior science and as it applies to human relationships, parenting, things like that. So if we're talking about parenting, I would say that would be one of the greatest gifts a parent could ever give themselves and their children is to just start to understand a little bit of behavior science.
Julia, I love that. I'm going to get that. I'm curious, actually. I have one question. I'm curious. There's someone listening, I'm sure, that's like, all right, I want to get started on this. You know, maybe they're the parent that I was all those years ago. What's their first step in all of your talking about now? I know, you know, definitely get the book, Raising Men. Read Eric's book, of course. But what's your first piece of advice for the person listening right now that just wants to get ahead of this or just start it?
You mean advice like a tip kind of advice or like a thing to go to or a resource?
Whatever you want to share with them.
I guess the next action step is what you're trying to say, correct?
That's a step.
Okay, baby. All right.
Yeah. So how do I say it? Yeah. There is that. You're like an action. You're like a step. Okay, I got
it. A step is action. You don't have to call it action. To take a like step, genius, honey.
Where do you come up with these words, honey? Thank you.
Eric, you got any dog collars lying around over there? To throw a dog collar or shock a little bit. And it won't be like gentle ones. It'll be the ones that really zing, you know?
Yeah, it could be subtle. You could change it during the podcast too.
a little thing in his pocket to push the button. That would be fun.
Oh, that is funny. So what I teach people, what I do, I'm going to do a little bit of a pitch, I suppose, here because what I do, how this was all about leaving a legacy for my children. Like, I want to teach my children because as an entrepreneur in 2008, I was like getting crushed. Like, this sucks. And everybody around me, their life sucked. I'm like, we can maybe make it, they can appear successful, but I'm like, this isn't working, guys. So when I built my site and my training platform, it started as just a personal endeavor to make sure that my kids had it. And then now it became this thing. So I use unconventional SEAL performance principles to help people execute an unconventional strategy that, you got to think about this, allows people to use their passion to fulfill their personal, financial, and business intentions. Another way you can say that is life balance. No real such thing as balance. You can say that harmonizing all concerns in life. So to me, that is the ultimate thing to do. Like, that would be the ultimate thing, is to learn that kind of thing and learn how to methodically establish your purpose and put strategies and tactics that will allow you to fulfill it. Think about that. Think about if you're the father or the mother, and what you've done is you've identified all the parts of life, all the parts of finances, all the parts of business and career. There's a lot, but it's not infinite. You know what I mean? Like, there's a chunk. But think about the advice, the authority, the leadership, the respect, the help you would be to other people. And in this context, to your children. Like, well, what if I'm the one who knows? Here's all the parts. Everybody wants to live a happy, healthy life, but nobody, how many people do you know all the parts of it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you wanted to build a really cool bicycle or just a skateboard, couldn't do it if you didn't know all the parts, bearings, trucks, wheels, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be my advice to everybody. Engage in that kind of thing and learn how to master life. And you, by doing so, you're going to be able to show your kids how to do it. Just like if you figured out your way through the jungle to the mountaintop, like, oh, I did it. And guys, if you want to go to the mountaintop, I can take you there and they'll follow.
And I was going to say, that was a soft pitch. Give me the other pitch. Where can the listeners get a hold of you, your website,
I wouldn't know
email.
Where to get that program.
Yeah. There you go. So you could go to averagefrog.com, like average as in see averagefrog.com. And there's a whole philosophy behind that. We are reconstructing our site, but there is something where you can get a free ebook. And that's like, I think it's Habits of Heroes. That's the four mistakes men make and the five ways to solve them. Good kind of starter for this conversation. It's meant to be a little bit of a wake-up call, but a man or a woman could go to that. But once you do that, you'll be on my email list. And then right away, you're in the machine, right? So right away, you'll get emails saying, hey, glad you're here. Here's some programs for you. And there's like a real like low dollar, $7 offer where you could get the first kind of hit of this philosophy. And then people can choose. It's, you know, it's designed to meet people where they are. They can ascend or use that. So averagefrog.com. Download that ebook. That'll get you on my list. And then you can engage how you need to.
You could have just said, that's the next step, Julia, right? I mean, you're
well, action.
The next step,
that's a big action.
Action,
a big
step.
Action step.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's a massive action step.
I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Yeah. This was awesome.
This is so helpful, so needed. I just want to thank you, Eric, for putting the book out, you know, making a difference in, because seriously, men really do need people like you, like my husband, to be out there speaking about this, because it is, that's why our society is where it is right now. So I just thank you, seriously.
My pleasure. Thank you guys.
Yeah,
thank you.
We have like such traditional. We want to thank Eric for being a great guest on the show and for spending part of your day with us. I'm Gino. She's Julia. We are Julia and Gino.
This is painful.
Come on.
Painful. I'm
trying to work that in here.
This is a little cheesy.
Gino and Julia. Oh, Julia and Gino. Thanks, Eric. Right. We appreciate you being
on
today.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Eric.